This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Kate. How are you going?
I feel like I'm always so formal when I say that, and it's always because you and I have just chatted for half an hour before we start recording. It's like a
transitional moment, isn't it?
Deeply transitional.
Very strange.
I want to say we'll be releasing this episode after you've already gone to have your time at Musk, of which I am, of course, deeply jealous, although I have made the decision not to be there this time. And you told me that you are planning to get a hell of a lot of words finished during that time, and also that you've basically got like a new book finished. And I love you, but it also hurt. It really hurt a lot. And I want to know how you did that. And I wonder if you might be able to give me a little bit of a pep talk on how to get some words out, because I'm struggling.
Oh, we'll see. I think that's edited highlights reel. I did have an ambitious goal for Musk, and I do still have it, but it's looking less and less likely. I was going to be going for 3 nights, I think, but now Carney desperately wants to go surfing on Sunday morning, so that's cutting into my time.
Carney, you can hear all of the writers going, boo, hiss, Carney.
It's worth it. It's worth it to get him surfing. It is.
Puts me in a good space. So good. That's such a good person.
Thing. But yeah, I was wondering that too recently. I have finished a manuscript, but I think the key thing is it's middle grade. And I think middle grade is a very different proposition to adult.
What, just because it's less words?
I think it's lighter in tone. It's a pretty conventional, when I think of what I know of your manuscript, I'm not surprised your brain is fractured. It's conventional in the sense it's a single person telling a single story. It's got this comic book element that I don't know if other people are interested in, but I really like. I think certainly the advice I've had so far, though no one has read the whole manuscript and seen the comics, is that comics are more suited to junior fiction. Anyway, I think it has just been easier because it's been a lighter.
When you say seen the comics, as in there are comics included in your middle grade manuscript?
Yeah. So it's got comics and like a few comic frames in it.
That
as
you
well.
Made so yourself?
That I made. And that's kind of, they're very rough. Like when I was doing the 90-day novel, I went through probably 40 or 50 days where I made myself do a comic of the protagonist that could potentially be inserted into the story or could just be a peripheral moment. So I have all these badly drawn comics that I've started to sort of put into more legible stick figures using a very little known program for illustrators, meaning a program that's not at all suited to what I'm doing, PowerPoint. So it's pretty rudimentary.
Can I just say the reason I'm silent and sitting here with my chin on my hand is because how did I not know that this is what you were doing in all of this time? It's like everyone thinks that you and I are like chatty all the time, which we are. How did I not know this?
I feel like I've mentioned it.
Damn it. Okay, I've just been completely self-involved and haven't listened.
No, I probably have only mentioned it in passing. We've just been reading a lot of comics this past year or two, both in terms of graphic novels in this house. I'm talking about kids stuff.
Yeah.
But also my mum, for my nieces and nephews, has bought hundreds of Simpson comics. And so my kids are now at an age where they can read them and largely not understand what is going on.
Love it.
Like the one where Marge has a boob job. but yeah, so comics are kind of a thing.
I'm so impressed. Okay, so do you think what struck me then as you were talking is also this, like, the fact that it's a bit of a different approach. It's different in tone, it's different kind of genre based or style. You're going at it with these comics. Do you think that has given you momentum?
Yeah, it has. The thing is, because what I like about comics is I think humorous writing is much easier in really short form. And I think comics do that. I think most comic writing is short form. Like McSweeney's is probably the number one sort of humorous website. That's short form. You got a lot of essayists that are short form. I think it's easier. There's no pressure. You can chuck it away. It's like if it exists in isolation, it's flash fiction. That's right. What it is. Okay. You, however, not coming to Musk.
I'm not coming to Musk because I'm going to the beach. So
you're going to the beach. So you've still got exciting things on. You've got life, PhD, podcast, book. Historically, you've written big chunks in big hits. In the absence of that, or are you getting words down, or have you got something up your sleeve that's going to bring it all together?
Yeah, you know, always have something up my sleeve. I have a few things booked in. I've got a word cave coming up, which will be ace.
Is the word cave doable at home?
I'm going to try and go away for part of it.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is, you know, like I'm going to turn this around just so you can see it and be appalled at what's next to me here. Like,
I will only ever be super jealous of your office.
Exactly. And this is the thing. Like, do not sit in your privileged little studio here, Kate, and whinge about it, except that I have to get away from – there's so much work going on in here.
There's a lot of visual. There's a lot of books.
There's a lot of books there. I probably did underestimate my yeses to festivals and the required reading, et cetera, for that. I love it. I love them all. I'm happy about it all. I'm a festival fairy, but I have underestimated that. So I think it's good. It's good to realize that one cannot write a book at the same time as like full-time doing everything else. I never know whether I can talk about things because of the PhD and ethics approval. Anyway, one of the things I'm really interested in looking at the moment is the combination of extroversion and writing, which I obviously have a fairly high level. And so I did one of those like really kind of just quick psychological tests on the internet the other day just to get, you know, baseline level of where my extroversion sits. Yeah, because it means that I love all this stuff. Love all the research, love going to the festivals, love talking to writers. Don't actually have the time to sit down and write the stupid book. Anyway, I came out at the quite high 98% extrovert.
Are you?
98%.
Wow.
Are you even allowed to be that? I don't know that you are. Anyway, it was very amusing. Something that I'm interested in writing about. But yes, I think I need some bigger amounts of time, which are coming up, and so that's good. I saw. Have you read this? Have you read Night Bitch by Rachel Yoda?
No, I've heard of it. Were you talking about it?
Yeah, I think Adelaide. I did. I heard her at Adelaide. So, but I've been following her on Twitter, and I saw her say the other day that she has got short stories building up. She feels pressurized, like she obviously can't write for whatever reason at the moment, but she's feeling like that thing of I'm going to blow with all of the stories in me. I want to feel that rather than feeling like I must sit down at my desk. It's the bullshit thing of having all this, the weight of going, okay, now I'm a full-time writer, which is crap. I'm not a full-time anything. I pick up the kids at 3:15. Like, oh, you know, I do
stay ever.
All of like the things. It's not full-time anything. I make money in other ways. But anyway, is that enough whinging about my life?
That's not how are you going to do it? Like, what's the answer? You're going to get away? I keep thinking of this New Zealand retreat.
Yeah. Going to New Zealand. Yeah, I'm going to New Zealand. I have, and I fully expect people to have feelings about this. I have reduced the time somewhat because I just decided that I could not do the full month, but that's okay. I'm going to do pretty close to that. I've made a page that says when I have to hit word counts by certain times, and I have utterly failed to hit those so far.
I should explain. That sounds like it would be a really formally written page. Scrap of paper that I can see has about three circles. It's barely legible writing in it. Like, it's not much of a plan. As someone who does Gantt charts and things for work, I don't know if that would fly.
Yeah. But I am also accepting of the fact that rather than getting to the end of each day and going, I'm a terrible person because I haven't written the words, if I actually look at the to-do list, realize that I can't actually get the words written today and that I am going to give myself a hell of a lot of time when after the school holidays to write hardcore.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing like a deadline.
Nothing like a deadline. And I do have a deadline. So watch this space. Watch this space. We have something new.
We do. This is very exciting. Something we are introducing into our fortnightly catch-ups. And it's a featured book section. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Ultimo Press, and we are very, very excited to be talking to Natasha Scholl, author of Found Wanting. Natasha Scholl is a Melbourne-based writer and lapsed lawyer. Her writing has appeared in The Age, Sydney Morning Herald, Good Weekend Magazine, SBS Voices, Mamma Mia, and elsewhere. She graduated from the University of Melbourne, majoring in creative writing. In 2020, she completed the Killier Darlings Mentors Program. Found Wanting is her debut book. Natasha, welcome. First up, can you give us the pitch for the book?
Sure. So Found Wanting is a memoir that begins on the night my partner Rob died when I was 22. But it is a story not just about grief and loss, but also, I guess, hope and joy and what happens the day after the worst day of your life and how to build a life in the space that death leaves behind, I guess.
You could call Found Wanting a grief memoir. You've obviously mentioned the word grief and it takes up where Rob kind of left off. Is that what the book is to you?
I think at first I really pushed against that. So I was really uncomfortable even just with the word memoir, because to me memoir was something by a celebrity or someone important or someone special or unique, and I didn't feel like that's what I was writing. But then at some point that sort of changed. It was almost like when I was pitching it as narrative nonfiction. I just couldn't use the word memoir. And then when it was picked up by Ultimo Press and we were sort of in the editing phases, I really embraced that term grief memoir, because I realized it isn't a memoir about me. It is a memoir about grief and loss. And it was really helpful in the editing process, because I could say, does this serve the story of grief? Does this add to the story of loss? Could this book now be about anyone? Like, I don't need to be the central character. I'm not the central character, even though there are many chapters that are quite revealing and exposing, but could I be substituted with anyone else? And would this story still hold true? So I think at some point I just totally embraced it and went for it. And I think the reason I was uncomfortable at first was there was sort of this negative connotation with grief memoir. I felt heavy and sad. But actually, if you're writing about grief, you're writing about life, in which case it's funny and humorous and absurd. And there are those moments in any grief memoir, I think. And I just didn't want it to be voyeuristic or self-indulgent. I think that's why I initially was uncomfortable. But in the end, it actually was quite a helpful sort of genre.
It's such a fascinating distinction. And I would say to readers, it is funny and it is a very hopeful book. There's a section where you talk about all the quiches that people bring. I think so many people who've had deaths would be familiar with the advent of a particular type of dish, which I feel like is season dependent.
Yeah, it could be lasagna, it could be quiche, it could be bolognese, but yeah, it's very familiar to a lot of people, I think.
Natasha, you've touched on this idea that how you saw the book and what it was about was something that evolved over time. You had a Kill Your Darlings mentorship in 2020. How did that help?
I think the reason I applied for it was because it would give me access to a real writer. At that stage, I didn't know anyone who'd had a book published, so it felt like this very sort of out of reach thing. And so I was mentored by Rebecca Stafford, and that was amazing just to have access to someone who'd been published who could give me advice. But also the other element, I mean, I started in pre-pandemic times. So we had these deadlines in place, which kept the writing moving. And my plan for 2020 was to have a day a week where I wouldn't accept any freelance work. I'd take the day off my day job and I'd really commit to writing like it was a job. And I'd started going to Stonington Library and working in cafes, and that was blissful for all of 2 weeks. And then the pandemic hit and every plan I had went out the window, obviously. So having that mentorship in place, it just kept things moving. I had a word count that I needed to send to her within certain time limits. And I was so close to the end of that very first draft that it really just pushed me to keep going, to have that sort of external person I didn't want to disappoint.
So was that the first draft was finished through COVID? Is that?
Yeah. The first draft was finished through COVID. And like, I don't recommend that, but I think I'd spent so long not writing. For so many years, I wanted to write and it just felt like too hard and too impossible. And in hindsight, you know, that's ridiculous. I had so much time on my hands. I just didn't realize it at the time. And then when time got snatched away from me, it was almost like I had to fight for it. And it gave me that fire. It's like something external was telling me I couldn't do it. And it just pushed me to say, I'll show you and I will make time and I will force my way into this. And look, it wasn't ideal, but I don't think that my book would end up the way it did had I not had that external pressure.
Yeah, there's something about the sense of urgency that just makes you do stuff.
Yeah, and you need a bit of fight to survive, I guess.
Particularly in lockdown. I think you need something of your own as well.
Yes.
Natasha, we know that Found Wanting ultimately ended up being published by Ultimo Press. How did it land in their hands?
So it was literally the submission portal on their website. So I was one of those slush pile success stories. They do happen. I sort of had this spreadsheet of people I was interested in, publishers that had been recommended. And in my head, I thought there's no way to crack into the industry unless you know someone, unless there's a connection, unless you're introduced personally. But I just gave it a go and made sure that I read the guidelines. Obviously, each publisher has separate guidelines. So I think it was the first three chapters. And Alex Craig responded and I got an email from in my inbox that said, send us the full manuscript. And it was just this, like my body went into shock when I got that, because it's something I wanted for so long, and that it was actually a possibility felt really surreal.
How long did it take between submission and receiving that wonderful email?
It was pretty fast, which I also think was the shock, because obviously those things do take time. So that was pretty much, I think, within a week or two. But then the next stage.
God.
Yeah, but then the next stage took quite a long time. So, yeah, that was really painful. And I just spent every day like refreshing my inbox and torturing myself and just being like, oh, no, it's not going to happen. And then, yeah, I knew it was going to acquisitions then after that. And, it took a little while, and patience is not my virtue. But the publishing industry works at a different pace, and I just had to sort of surrender to the process. Everything either happens very slowly or very quickly, and there's sort of no in between.
That's a very accurate summation. Found Wanting came out in Feb this year. What's been the best part so far about the publishing adventure?
I think the connections that I've made in terms of just being really embraced by the community. I think before publication, I'd assumed it felt so hard to get published and so impossible that I assumed there were all these gatekeepers and people sort of, I don't know, separating you from entry. But actually, it's kind of the opposite. And everyone is sort of supporting each other. And there are all these cheerleaders behind the scenes. And it's been really remarkable. And just having people, you know, that I listened to on the first time podcast when I was in, you know, the writing process of this book and really like taking notes of, okay, well, they can be my inspiration. And now they're sort of, I'm meeting them and I'm a bit in awe, and or they've said, I've read your book. And it's just, it's wild to think that I'm on the other side. Like, I'm like, do you know who you are? Like, why are you talking to me? So it's been a bit amazing just to see that support and how everyone is really rallying for each other.
I should also point out to listeners that you are the author of the tweet that we've mentioned more than once on the show, which was a bit of a rallying cry for community, I think.
It was.
So you've mentioned the best bits about the publishing adventure. What have been the most challenging?
I think pre-publication, my goal was to get published. Like, that was it. I had no further expectations than that. And that would have been, you know, the ultimate goal. And then at some point, I guess the goalposts kept changing. Only, like, I was the one changing them. It's no pressure by anyone else. But what success looked like is hard to define, I guess, because it's all new. I've got no context for it. So what started as I just need to be published and then I'll feel like I made it suddenly becomes I'll feel like I made it if I'm invited on that podcast, or I'll feel like I've made it if I'm invited to that festival or I'm reviewed in that paper. And the buzz you get from these things is so short-lived that you're always sort of chasing that next publication high. And yeah, that's not something I expected. I just thought I'd wake up on the day of release and think, okay, that's it. But actually, yeah, I guess the benchmark for success keeps changing a bit. So it's hard to ever satisfy that urge.
Yeah, I think that really resonates. I think it also is, there's a negative element to it. Like it's addictive, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, yeah. So moorish.
Yeah. And whatever used to give you that little high, all of a sudden it doesn't anymore. So yeah, I think addictive is definitely the right term for it.
Natasha, we have a lot of listeners to the show that write themselves, and we are always on the lookout for writing advice. What's the best advice you've either received or have for others?
Well, this is not new advice because I've heard this advice as a listener to the First Time podcast, but I think it's so important, which is to read, and to read not just as a writer in terms of being, you know, inspired by someone's work or looking at it from a craft perspective, but to read as a reader. And to keep that sense of awe and wonder, because that's why you write. Like, you have to look at the flip side of it as well, and to just nurture that relationship with books, I guess, because writing can be so isolating and you lose that perspective of, oh my God, why am I doing this? That to really nurture that relationship with books, I think, is so important. And it's almost like this sort of karmic contract or some sort of cosmic force at play where you say, okay, I will nurture books and I will put that energy into being a reader, and at some point there's that sort of payoff as well. And I think the other advice is not necessarily to listen to all advice, because I know at some points I was quite overwhelmed. You know, people would talk about morning pages and I would say, that doesn't work for me. That's not how I write best, but maybe I'm not a real writer if I can't do morning pages. If I need to go for a run first thing in the morning, I need to move my body. That's how my brain works. So we've all got different pressures and time constraints and work commitments and family commitments. So I think it's about saying, how am I productive as a writer? What works best for me? It doesn't need to be the same word count that another author I heard on a podcast has, or I don't need to write X hours a day. I need to work out, how am I my best writerly self, and really commit to that and just sort of work with blinders on and ignore the noise.
I think those pieces of advice are very, very, very useful, particularly the advice to read. Final question. We always like to go out on this note. Can you recommend a book by a debut author, anytime, any genre?
I certainly can. So I recently finished The Keepers by Al Campbell, and it is one of those books that changes you. Like, you feel changed after putting it down. I'm still thinking about it now. It is beautiful at a sentence level, but just the themes, I think, are so important, and I'm really excited to see what she does next.
Natasha, before I let you go, have you got any events coming up? Where can listeners find you?
I have an event with Melbourne Jewish Book Week in May, and I've got a few festivals coming up later in the year. So I overshare on the socials, so on Instagram or Twitter, where I will be posting events.
And we'll post links in the show notes. Okay.
We're back. Mm-hmm. Catherine.
Yes.
We've been consuming some literary things, but before we get onto that, you are still doing Wordle like the rest of the world and not me.
Are you not doing it?
I'm not doing it, all right? I'm not doing it. I'm trying to be a rebel.
Oh, my God. I know way too much about Wordle. I followed a post, maybe it was on Shameless or something on Instagram, where people were talking about their first words, mm-hmm. like as in what word they put in first. That's where I learned, A, that people don't necessarily always do the same first word, and B, that sometimes people will get letters highlighted in the first word and not use them in the second word. I know, mind-blowing. And one woman said what I think has gamified Wordle for me. She has two standard words that she always uses. And so now I use her two standard words, first and second. And I think I get Wordle in a minimum of well, in a maximum of four based on these words. And the first word is audio, and the which has four vowels. And the second word is stern, which has the other vowel and common consonants. It's really, I'm so impressed. Anyway, I've read other articles that suggest other words, but that combination, I think, makes wordable 100% of the time solvable.
Okay, so here's a couple of things. A, I would like our listeners to maybe get in contact, engage, bring some salad to the socials and tell us about how they're doing Wordle. Or perhaps you're like me and you've decided just to like stay out of the whole thing.
Are you out of it? Did you ever do it? No, I'm not only a word game person.
No, I'm the same. I'm the only person who goes camping who doesn't do cryptics. And they're like, you should be doing cryptics. Yeah. You write the books. So I'm like, no, I can't. Yeah. I'm not into it. I don't want to think about words. Sometimes I spend all day thinking up of the right word.
Yeah.
That's my job. But also I want to know how much brain space this is taking up in your life. No.
Only like 15 minutes.
Okay, great. All right.
Generally do it on work time.
Great. Excellent. Listeners, when you get in touch with us, tell us if you are doing Wordle on work time on someone else's dollar. That's excellent. I love it. We want to start bringing some, not necessarily lit goss, but kind of lit world ideas. You read something interesting this week. What was it?
I'm not sure if you had seen this or not, but there was an article in The Guardian, and it is a series of letters between Elena Ferrante, who is the author of My Brilliant Friend and the Neapolitan series. I loved those books.
A real one? Like it's really her?
Really her.
Yep.
100% her, who's obviously known for being anonymous.
Yep.
And Elizabeth Strout, who wrote Olive Kitteridge, Lucy Barton.
Damn it, I have not read these, and I now will go and do it because...
Well, they're interesting because... So Elena Ferrante's released a book on reading and writing that I haven't read called In the Margins. And so the letters are basically Elizabeth Strout writes to Elena Ferrante about the ideas in the book and sort of is interested in X and can you tell me a little bit more about Y? Elena writes back and so they each write two letters to each other. I probably, if I'm very honest, are less interested in the content. Like it's very, the feel of Elena Ferrante's book is very literary. They're talking about I and who I is as a writer.
Yep.
But in terms of like a PR piece and a way to promote a book, because essentially that's what it is, it's really interesting.
Not that either of them need to, PR to promote their books.
But you get a sense of their voice. They're very polished in the writing, very mutually admiring. But they have these little moments where they say things like Ferrante talks about how she's got Elizabeth Strout's, I think it's Lucy Barton book, on her special bookshelf with highlighted passages.
Oh, that's so nice. So I've been thinking about this a lot, partly because of that, the interview with Bernadette Brennan, which is coming up soon, and about her going through the archives, Helen Garner's archives and Gillian Meir's archives, and this conversation that we have in that interview about what is lost now that writers don't necessarily correspond in letters anymore and that they won't be kept in the archive. So I want to ask you, question without notice, if you could correspond in an ongoing handwritten or email kind of way with one writer, who would it be?
Oh, that is such a hard question. That's up there with like, what's your favorite book?
I know, but can you give me like a top five maybe?
I'm turning around and madly looking at my books. One of the people that just popped into my head is Kevin Kwan, who did all the, like those, what has he done? Rich China Girlfriend and all those sorts of books. Catcher in the Rye, I would do Challenger. Who else would I do? I feel like we get to do a little bit of this. I'm thinking of Andy Griffith. I'm so excited to interview him in a couple of episodes coming up. Also because I've just read a lot of stuff that he's written about writing and spoken about writing. So
I'm so looking forward to that interview.
Do you have someone that you would write to?
Well, isn't it interesting? It's the same. I feel the same is that we have this privileged little moment of, in advance of interviews of having that back and forth or afterwards sometimes, which is really lovely, especially if you're kind of continuing a conversation. Sometimes that happens after panels as well, where you're kind of continuing a conversation that happened on stage. I love that. I must say, and this is going to be the thing that I've been listening to is this podcast with Anthony Doerr, who everyone knows I'm lit crushing on hard at the moment because of Cloud Cuckoo Land. And I'm so fascinated by that book and the way it was put together. I reckon I could enjoy quite a long correspondence just on how that works and how that happened. But that is not my final answer. So
Not having a final answer on that. Yeah, I want to
All right, we'll take this on notice.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that for a long time. That's like a dinner party.
It is. It is like a dinner party thing. I read something interesting that I want to tell you, and partly the reason I want to talk about it is that it came at me via lots of different groups, lots of different like writing message groups, etc. So a number of people are reading this for different reasons, and it's an article by Jane Rawson on Arts Hub. It's called The Many Lost Paths to a Novel. We'll put links in for all of this. So Jane Rawson's got a new book coming out very soon. I've got it here. It's called A History of Dreams. I have not read it yet, and I'm actually taking this to the beach with me. I'm so excited to read it. But this article that she writes is about this idea that the finished book, she says, a finished book feels as though it is the book it has always been, and then goes on to explain that, of course, this book has looked very different in all its different incarnations. And it's so interesting. And I think it's the reason, it's one of the reasons I'm so interested in talking to writers about the writing process and why I'm kind of obsessed with the writing process, because I think it's so validating to hear people say, my book looked very different at different stages, you know, or it came out of this idea and then it looked like this for a while and then it looked, you know, like something completely different. And I actually think Sarah Winman talks a little bit about it in the Masters episode we've released with her, about that there's another kind of novel within Still Life that, you know, that didn't really come out but could have come out. And I just think that stuff is so interesting. But it's a really great article. I highly recommend it to everyone.
I think that's sometimes maybe why people write sequels, because the characters, I mean, it's a different thing, but that idea that I was listening to that Office Ladies podcast that I love today, and they were talking about episodes of The Office, and if a scene has been written and filmed but then is cut from the episode, does that still exist in the life of the character?
Ah.
And so the women were saying, well, we think that if it's been cut, then that never happened. But then one of them was saying, actually, the director said in an interview that he believes, and that the writers believe, that as long as the episode was written and got to the point of being filmed, then it is part of that character's story, which only is relevant in like really long sort of series where you have callbacks to certain aspects of people's lives.
That's so interesting. That goes a little bit to that idea. You know how I was so fascinated when Maggie Shipstead said that if it doesn't happen on the page, it hasn't happened for her characters, whereas lots and lots of people have those extensive kind of character notes and backstories written up, or 100,000 words that they've cut, which are true but didn't make it onto the page. Yeah. So and interesting to me.
I reckon if you write those words, I would find them hard to take out of the story of that character.
Yeah, for sure. You do that a bit in 90 Day Novel, don't you? Like you kind of do a lot of that.
Heaps of that. And I found it really helpful. I really liked it.
Yeah, I use a lot of those exercises just as one-offs. Okay, tell us. Oh, sorry, you're about to say something. Go.
Oh, I was going to say I'm interested to see Graham Simsion's just released a book on writing. I'm interested to see how he approaches it, because I suspect he has not a 90-day novel format, but I think he would be equally structured.
I suspect he will. That book is on that pile behind me over there and haven't got to it yet. Will, sometime. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a book called Every Day is Gertie Day by Helen Meaney. This was one of the La Novella Prize winners. The other prize
was cool.
Christine Ballantyne's Water Music. It's cool. It's the weirdest premise. It is about, it's sort of set in the near future. There was a woman who, before the book starts, died in her house. Her name was Gertrude something. And she was painted by a painter before she died, and in the painting she has elf ears. In real life she doesn't have elf ears, but when she dies the paintings end up being significant and people start getting their ears sort of plastic surgeried to look like elf ears. So it's this like weird premise, but it's treated with complete logic. And it's so surprising how many kind of cultural issues she can explore within this idea of like factions within the elf ear.
Oh my God. That is so
group.
Cool.
Yeah. It's really cool. I highly, highly recommend it. And the beauty of novellas is, I mean, they're shorter, obviously, but they can really sustain a single idea or a like it's complexity in exploration, but it has a straight through line. It's good.
Love that.
Today is Bertie Day.
I will put that on my list. I have just finished reading and laughing and enjoying deeply Tony Jordan's Dinner with the Schnabels. I think that's how you pronounce it. I loved it. It's like pure Tony Jordan, just smart, witty.
I spoke to her about that. I saw her at a event and she was saying, I said schnabels, and she was like,
Schnabels.
I think she said it the way you said it.
Great.
But she was like, just, I thought it was a funny name. Sounds a bit like schnitzel.
Yeah,
schnitzel.
It is funny. And I love that she can just do whatever the hell she wants with things because she's so damn good at her craft. That's very exciting. On the day that this episode releases, it will be Monday the 4th of April. And if you listeners want to get along to an event, I am speaking to Tony for Eltham Bookshop, not at Eltham Bookshop, but in Eltham, about the book. And I'm just so looking forward to talking to her about
it. Why not at Eltham Bookshop?
Because it's not big enough. So they have events down at Edendale Farm, which is very cool. And the other thing that I want to mention is I got this month's quarter, whatever they do, episode of Mianjin, which I haven't got for a while, and I'm so glad I got it. And I have just finished reading this incredible essay by Alice Bishop on elective egg freezing during COVID. It's called A Steady Gamble, and it is just really damn good. And I want to press it in the hands of lots of people, but I haven't even got around to the rest of the articles in here yet, but I'm looking forward to it. So that is coming to the beach with me as well.
How many books do you take to the beach?
Well, remember us discussing after the summer holiday how I had had my least bookish time ever?
It's the extrovert, isn't it?
It's the extrovert. So who knows? There's a few that are on my list that I need to be reading. So, you know, maybe I'll take 4. Daylight Savings will be done while we're at the beach. So then there's also a little bit more nighttime fire time, which can sometimes lead to bedtime being earlier or can sometimes lead to the next bottle of wine being opened and the grown-ups sitting around chatting around the fire. So who knows what will happen? Who knows? What have you been watching? Let me guess.
Oh my God. Rapidly hitting new lows. Below Deck, the yachting series. What I will say though, and I have also been
watching. Is this the one Els Fitzgerald recommended to you? Is she watching this?
I think she is actually.
Yeah,
Below Deck's sort of an upstairs, downstairs set on a yacht, but there's also Summer House, Winter House. What I will say though is that one thing that is really interesting about reality shows, particularly coming out of America, is they're exploring race in such interesting ways. And some of it is just the conversations that come up by virtue of having a diverse cast. Like it's incredible how much the kind of promise of inclusion delivers.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting. There's an episode, for example, where there's two sort of Black African-American girls within a house of largely white people. And one guy keeps mixing the girls' names up or mix up one of the girls' names, and she gets really, really upset about it. And it's, so then they have this sort of larger discussion. But it's genuinely educational is where I'm placing it. I mean, there's other stuff that's really not educational. But one other thing that they do a lot now, which I also find interesting in the context of climate change, is so they have Winter House is set in winter at like a skiing sort of snow setting. They keep flashing up the month and the temperature in, and the people will be saying, oh, it's weirdly hot. It's weirdly hot. Also just kind of a pointed comment.
Yeah.
Good. Interesting. Unfortunately it's in Fahrenheit, so not that useful for an Australian audience. But it's funny how you can still make a comment on something while being so far removed from it.
Sometimes I fear, Catherine Collette, that you are going to find yourself another podcast person to talk about, just purely go down the analysis and commentary on reality series, and it, you'll just like
Twitter stalk during while watching, after watching. I like, yeah, obsessed. Oh, I mean, maths would be the other one to talk about in Australia, but we won't. That's where
could
I've
this
drawn
be your
line.
Could this be like simmering away underneath your next novel?
I think it's actually one of those things that's I've read novels that have been set around or attempted to be set around reality TV. I think reality TV is interesting enough for nonfiction. Mm. I think it's more interesting in that space.
Watch this space. And Catherine
I could also just be justifying terribly lowbrow TVs. Like there's a lot of stuff that's
you can do that. Not the best. That's okay.
What have you been watching? My heart.
Well, I had things. I was going to talk about Troppo, which is based on Crimson Lake by Candace Fox, which is amazing, except last night I discovered that my husband has been watching episodes without me. So I don't feel like I can talk about it to the proper extent one would, you know, comment.
But that's crushing.
So, crushing,
what
right?
was he then planning to do? To rewatch with you? And
well, here's the thing, because sometimes I like a show where I can just lay on the couch and I will preempt it by saying, I'm probably going to fall asleep right now, okay, but I'm just like really happy for the TV to be on. Like, this is just chill time.
Yeah.
So he pretended, he was all like, oh, are we up to episode 3 or 4? And I was like, oh, babe, you know, that's okay. Like I can go. And then he was like, oh, well then I might just go on and watch where I'm up to. I was like, are you serious?
Crushing.
Anyway, so I'm not going to talk about that, even though it's wildly good. I'm going to talk about, and we'll put a link into this, something that I found when I went down a big climate-y, after that Antarctica news this week, I went down a rabbit hole. I've just ordered Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future, which I really want to read. And I'm a bit of a Kim Stanley Robinson fan. And I found this ACE TED Talk he did, which is about like the history of how we fixed the world from 2071. And it's talking about the 2020s and what happened. And he has this very kind of utopian, it's not utopian, it's partly utopian. Specific people don't come at me because I don't know how to use all the right words, but he does do this extraordinary kind of leap forward where we've had all the crises and the terrible heat waves and heaps of people have died, and he looks at a new way forward, particularly in terms of economics. And it's really interesting. But just as a like 8-minute kind of letter, it's a really beautiful thing to watch and quite hopeful. So we'll put a link in to that as well.
Wow, that sounds incredible, because he will be right about some stuff inevitably.
Yeah, well, he's like an incredible brain, like his science on stuff, and it makes a lot of sense. And this beautiful way of him saying, you know, the 2020s were really hard, like after the pandemic, and then we had this heat wave, and then the heat waves of 27, you know, were incredibly hard, but we were, and I've heard him talk in another interview saying, you know, we're going a little bit faster in terms of making change than people thought we would. And maybe it is partly the pandemic, and maybe it is partly people realizing the speed of what's happening to us, that we need to get a move on, or this is going to be beyond us. So, in terms of the fact that I've spent, like I know you have, a lot of years doing all the reading and feeling so incredibly crushed by it. Like I cannot read another thing about the climate crisis because I'm not going to be able to get out of bed. Reading Kim Stanley Robinson, I find to be quite innovating, if that's the right word.
Mm.
Listening. Tell us what you're listening to.
R.A. Spratt, vicariously. R.A. Spratt has a podcast. I can't remember if I've mentioned this.
I don't think you
have. Does this ring a bell? I've posted about it on Instagram. She has a podcast. She is the author of Friday Barnes and Nanny Piggins and a bunch of other books for kids. She writes new stuff for this podcast. There are a lot of episodes. They at least come out weekly, if not more often than that. She both writes them and performs them. My kids are obsessed.
Oh my gosh, I need this.
Particular is genuinely funny. So Tilly's, you know, really, really into it. She's 8. Oscar's also into it. He's 6. It's so good. So she has a thing where every episode, which is actually really effective for kids, and I believe in anyway, but particularly when doing podcasts for kids, has a thing of like, if you want to support this, buy the book or buy me a coffee. So it's not behind a paywall or anything, but it bloody should be. It is so good.
Right. I am putting that in for the long drive.
It's really good. And interesting because I think it could be one of, like, I think she could monetize it. Like, as in, I do wonder if she gets, and I do hope she gets the level of support that, because it would be a lot of work, but it really hits the mark.
I think we know that generally when we watch women in the arts doing things that take up a lot of time, they're not actually being compensated for that time at all.
I'm hopeful. This is really good. Anyway.
Excellent.
I shan't ask her.
She could add to our list. The one that I wanted to mention last week, which I'd forgotten about, was called Shelter in Place, the Shelter in Place podcast, which has, I went in again because of my Cloud Cuckoo Land obsession to listen to the Anthony Doerr episode, which is really wonderful, and we'll share a link, and quite hopeful as well. But then I went back and started listening to some of the other episodes, and in particular, the start, as the woman who runs it, whose name's escaped me for a second, talks about they're also running a training program for women in audio, and it just sounded very, very cool. So I'm looking forward to exploring more of that podcast, the Shelter in Place podcast.
Hi, this is Catherine. I just wanted to mention a live event that both Kate and I are hosting at the Wheeler Centre on Tuesday, 12th of April at 6:30 p.m. The Wheeler Centre is in Melbourne. It is us with Robert Lukens, author of Loveland, and Yamna Kassab, who's the author of Australiana. The theme is Second Times, but we'll be talking about the usual writing and books and publishing stuff. The event is free, but you need to book, and you can do that via the Wheeler Centre website. We'll also have links on our Instagram page and in the show notes. Hope to see you there.
Okay. See ya. Have fun at
Mask. Our bags.
Oh my gosh, I know. Have fun. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.